Okay, now we're official.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining the August SIO Story Lab. Our special guest is Lori Silverman, and we were very excited to have Lori be our SIO Lab speaker most recently, and this is kind of a follow-up and an extension of what we covered before. She's going to be covering today and talking about Future Story. And what's really interesting is that at least since the time that Lori had spoken with us last, I've heard the term Future Story used in a number of different ways and in some articles here and there. So I'm very excited to have Lori join us again today. For those of you who may be new, Lori is very experienced, not only storyteller, but story trainer. She's written a couple of really great books, both of which I have on my bookshelf, Wake Me Up When the Data Is Over, as well as the book, in fact, I'm turning around and looking, Business Storytelling for Dummies. And I love both books. I think they both provide a lot of great insight and some specific examples. And Lori, I'd love to maybe kind of have you kick it off. Just so you know, and everybody on the phone knows, our standard format is, you know, we'll probably go through about 30 or so minutes worth of opportunity to have Lori share with us some of her wisdom and insight, and then we'll leave some time, about 10, 15 minutes for Q&A, and then we can go from there. But Lori, so what is Future Story and how does that work?
Well, you know, I first heard the term back in probably the 2004-2005 timeframe when Madeline Blair was helping us as one of the contributors to the book, Wake Me Up When the Data Is Over. And I, at that time, we collected one actual example of what today I would call a project vision story, which is a type of future story. But I, you know, from my perspective, I really didn't think much about it. I am a strategist by background. But I would say it's only in the past couple years since we wrote the Dummies book that I started to ask myself, are there different types of future stories? So what all different types of future stories have in common is that they talk about a future, imagined, possible, attractive, desirable state. And so what I'd like to talk about today, and also get some input and feedback from people who are on the call, even more than perhaps just taking questions, is I have identified so far four different types of what I call future stories, and I'm going to talk about it at the organizational level, although these all apply at the individual level as well. So if you're doing coaching or executive coaching or mentoring with people, you could use these terms with them as well, and these types of stories as well. They just happen to be more prevalent right now, I think, in the business arena for for-profit and nonprofit companies. So you tell me which way you want to go, Mark. We can talk about each of these different types, or I can do something more general, but the four types of future stories that I've identified are the one that's most, I think, prevalent that we all know about are what we call vision stories. And this would be like, what does done look like? So if you think about crafting a strategy for an organization that looks out 5 years, then this particular story would be co-created by a variety of diverse people in an organization to talk about what the end might be, what might look like, sound like, taste like, feel like, and how might it be actualized. And what I'd like to add to that is I think that today what we now know, and Martin Luther King was, I think, a real key to this, as well as other leaders throughout history, but is also to add to a vision story, which is co-created, a type of future story called a dream story that every single person has. And so we often talk today about individual leaders having their own dreams, yet that doesn't mean that that dream will be embraced by the totality of the organization, that that leader would need to add their dream to what is being co-created for a vision story. And then the other types One that's out in the strategic planning literature that's very common is what people talk about as scenario stories, and so we can talk about how those are developed if you'd like. And then the final type that I've identified is what I call that did we make the right decision story? Are we doing the right sort of thing? Because at the forefront of strategy, people keep asking that question. You know, are you sure this is the right path? Are we doing the right sorts of things? Shouldn't we be doing something else instead? And so we oftentimes have to tell those stories as a predecessor to people being able to receive a dream story or a co-created vision story. So what direction would you like me to take the conversation in for those who are on the call?
Anybody have a preference?
They all sound great. I mean, and this is Tricia. I'd be happy with any one of them. I think I'm kind of leaning into I don't know, maybe starting with the vision story. Is there a chance we could touch on each one of them as we go through?
Sure. So what I can do is let me give you an example of an organization that I worked with several years ago who used all four of them and the order in which they used them in. I'll tell you, this was not planned, so it ended up being quite serendipitous. But I think it will also take us into another conversation around how do these vision stories get presented to individuals. So if I can start with that, I'll do a high level overview, and then we can do a deeper dive if you'd like. So a number of years ago, I worked for the American Legion Auxiliary, and what was really cool, and I think today actually served us very well up front, is while they wanted to bring me on to do a strategic plan for them, they actually brought me in first to do workshops on business storytelling for their members and their leaders. Now, at the time, the organization was close to 1 million members, so anytime you might have a meeting, you're going to get several hundred people who show up, and they just organize. You oftentimes don't know everyone who's coming. So when I did my first workshop on business storytelling, we had between 300 and 400 people. So that was a way for people to get to know me and to embrace a concept which for them was near and dear to their heart, because they oftentimes use stories as a way to transmit tribal knowledge throughout all of their different units across the country. So when it came time to do strategic planning, we had a group of 75 individuals, diverse individuals from age 16 to women in their 80s, who worked together on strategy. But one of the pieces we did first was a scenario. So what you do to get at scenario questions is you oftentimes have to do some level of environmental scanning first. And what I mean by that is you can't do strategy just by thinking about what is resident in each person's brain and extrapolating to the future, because that leaves us with some gaps. You really have to live in a particular year in the future. And I think we were doing this work back in 2007, 2008, so we were living in the world of 2025, I believe. And we learned a lot about all of the different trends and wild cards and uncertainties and threats and other sorts of things that assumptions about what the future would be like. And then we identified two things. We identified a scenario question, which is critical, that we wanted to answer in doing strategy. And then we also identified, I'm blanking here for a minute. I mentioned the year, the scenario question, we identified two uncertainties from the list of trends that we thought were most key for us to study. So we wanted to look at how will veterans and their families live their lives in the year 2025? That was our scenario question. And from that scenario question, we had two variables, which gave us what I call four worlds. if you're more interested in scenario planning, I can send you an article on that. But for the sake of our conversation today, what's most important is that these four worlds are have constraints on them. And stories are written about each of the four worlds. So that's how the members first, these 75 people broke into four groups of almost 20 people apiece. And with information about the future and their constraints, they wrote a story about a specific character and that related to the question, how will veterans and their families live their lives in 2025? For strategy purposes, we took those four stories, and what people did is not only titled those stories and read them to all of us, but they also told us that if this world were to be the world that existed in 2025, what would have had to have happened going back every 5 years? So what would have to have happened in 2020 for their world to exist, or 2015 or 2010, and so on? And the reason we do this for strategy and the way in which scenario stories are so powerful is it's my contention that you do not pick a particular scenario and say, that's the way the future is going to be. That's the world that we're going to create our breakthrough strategies within. More what you do is you say, wow, look at these four stories. Look at how similar they are and look at how wildly different they are. If we want to have any strategies that are going to exist even a year from now, those strategies have to be able to live and breathe in each one of those stories. So that as the world continually changes and shifts, we don't have to change our strategies all that much, unless a wild card gets invoked. So for them, that was, their eyes were really opened up to two things. One was, oh my gosh, look at what could potentially happen in the future. And second, they really learned story by applying it to a very real business situation that they needed to forward in terms of a strategic plan, because that became our input to deciding on what the future strategies of the organization would be. What was then decided by the board was that we would, because not all of the 52 board members could participate in strategic planning, only some of them did, and along with a bunch of members, is we held what's called a real-time strategic change event in Washington, D.C. for about 350 women. And we designed it based on an equation for change. It has three elements, dissatisfaction with the status quo, times multiplied by vision, multiplied by first steps. And so before we ever shared these scenario stories with people, what we did, and I'll just talk about the story pieces, is the current president, the volunteer president of the organization, shared her story around why this change is needed. And it was actually a personal story that I helped her to capture and craft and come up with a key point to. And that story then kicked off after she told it. The dream story by the next three incoming presidents of the organization, and I have to tell you, this is very... this was hugely a shift, I think, for them, because every year when you came on as a new president, you got to oftentimes choose your own theme or what your emphasis was going to be for the year. And now what was going to happen was that the organization was actually going to embrace the same overarching strategies for the next several years. And so in order to really showcase that, I want you to imagine, and I did not assist with this, which for me, I actually was, I thought was really cool, because three incoming leaders got together, they co-crafted a dream story, and the way that it was given to this group of 350 is I want you to imagine on stage a bedroom set, and in the bedroom was a bed, and a chair at a desk, and an easy chair that walked back and forth. And we had some large stuffed animals, because each of these women either had cats or dogs or something. But what they learned when they were crafting their dream story is that all three of them journal, and they journal at night. And so one journals sitting in her chair at the desk, another journals in her easy chair, and another journals sitting on the bed. So we had them dressed in their pajamas, and our audio crew tape recorded them telling the story in advance so we could play it at a little bit faster speed for the audience. But the voices changed mid-sentence. So I want you to imagine one incoming president maybe saying four or five sentences, and then in the middle of a sentence, the second person taking over and maybe saying four or five sentences, and then the third person. Then it might go back to the second person, and then to the third person, and then to the first person again until the story was shared with everyone. And it was this beautiful display of, without ever saying it, that we're going to collaborate and work together on our dream. After that, we did something a little bit different. We didn't put together a vision story for the organization and the organization's vision. We put together skits, vision story skits. They were plays. They were about 8 minutes apiece, one on each of the breakthrough strategies that they were going to embrace for the next 5 years. And they were all wildly different. I remember one being a skit about technology, but it was held in a house, because one of the big things was, could employees, could they have technology where employees could work from home and members and prospective members could access signing up for membership and getting information that they needed 24/7 and actually have a wealth more information at their fingertips. So imagine a scene where the main character is someone in her 20s and she's sitting at a computer and her grandmother, who is ill, is laying in bed and they're having this conversation and she's telling her grandmother about what's going on, and then someone comes in the house and says, oh, you know, so-and-so is interested in becoming a member. Oh, yeah, I can put them on right away, and does that. And then there's a little bit of comedic interlude in the scene where grandma falls out of bed. So everybody could see that being at home was actually really good because they could help her then. So that was like the first skit. And then the second skit was, I don't remember the specific breakthrough strategy, but I remember that it was a series of story letters written between two sisters, one who was in the States and one who was deployed overseas as part of the military. And there are stories back and forth about, and I think it may have had to have done with the organization had a strategy around how do we become the go-to place for all information that any family member or troop may need when they come home. And so they talked about all of that through their stories. And then there was a third skit that took place as well. And that one was actually written as an infomercial. And I have to tell you, after all three of them were done, I think the audience really understood what was going to happen, because what we did to debrief these, instead of saying to them, what did you hear or what meaning do these stories have for you, we had them create collages, collage stories. And we had underneath their tables, we had gotten all these amazing supplies for them, magazines and scissors and tape and, you know, all sorts of fancy, like, of things that you might use if you're doing crafting. And we gave them some time to create a visual story around what they heard, versus trying to put it into words. Because as you know, when you're getting information that's so new and different and perhaps might not be consistent with your own mental model about where the future of the organization's going, it's best to draw out from more of the unconscious mind than the conscious mind what it is that you saw and heard and the meaning that it held. And we ended up having about 40 the posters, huge posters that were created, and we displayed them on easels around the room. And that was our way of getting feedback. And I'll tell you, the feedback was fascinating, because three of the posters were not all that positive. And so we were able to kind of say, oh, my goodness gracious, you know, what is it that we need to address the next day when these women come back and work with us? Because we were meeting for a Saturday afternoon into the early evening, and they were going to rejoin us again on Sunday until about mid-afternoon, and then their board was going to vote and ratify the strategy. Now, closing this particular piece, and so we can open it up perhaps to questions or observations, one of the things that was told to me is that it was very rare for a vote on anything to take less than many, many hours of the board time. So I was told to go have a very lengthy dinner and that the board would start a meeting and to come back whenever I wanted to. And I came back after about an hour and a half. And to my surprise, the board members were already in the bar having their celebratory drinks. They had finished their meeting, I think, in about an hour, and they had voted to ratify the strategy going forward.
Wow.
So, it was really like, I mean, I wish I could do this again. You know, it's hard. It's sometimes a challenge to find an organization that really wants to, like, embrace all of it. And yet I didn't even know what we were doing. I don't mean to say that I'm not mindful or strategic as a strategist, but that sometimes things just unfold in a way that when you look back at them in hindsight, you go, wow, those were really amazing times.
Kind of story serendipity, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for those words. They're very nice.
So I'm curious, what questions do folks have?
Lori, this is Bill White. I'm interested in the scenario stories, and in particular, if you could give us kind of an example of what sorts of constraints the folks in your meeting were dealing with as they crafted those stories.
I can give you one from another client because I don't have that one in front of me at the moment. So I want you to imagine that a group has read a bunch of articles about the future, so let's just say 2025, and then they have brainstormed a list of trends that will happen in that year. What we do is weighted voting. We ask people to vote on the two trends that to them are the most uncertain, so the ones that will have the most variation. And then what we do is we create anchors for each of those two uncertainties. So one example that comes to mind is a group that I worked with, and one of their uncertainties was health of the planet. And so they anchored that as the planet would have minimal health effects, or the other anchor was the planet would have adverse health effects. And by minimal and adverse health effects, what they meant were things that we're seeing now, like the Zika virus, like Ebola, and so on. So that's what they meant. They had operationally defined what health effects meant. And then the second uncertainty that they chose was the distribution in economic wealth and dominance. And the two anchors there were names of countries. The first group of countries was the typical countries that we think about when we think about wealth in around the world, and that's the U.S., Western Europe, and Japan. And then the second group was India, China, Asia, and Indonesia. So now what I want you to imagine is that you matrix those, and you're going to get four different possible worlds. So you're going to get one world where the constraints are minimal health effects, and wealth is held by the U.S., Western Europe, and Japan. Then you're going to have another world where there's minimal health effects, and the wealth is held by the developing nations of India, China, Asia, and Indonesia. Then you're going to have another world where there are adverse health effects, and the other constraint is that's happening in the U.S., Western Europe, and Japan, or you're going to have adverse health effects in India, China, Asia, and Indonesia. So that's how you get your constraints, and then you answer the scenario question with those two constraints and along with it, all the trends that you brainstormed earlier. Because people have said those are the things that are going to happen, so they have to be true in your world when you're describing it.
I'll
have to tell you what I've learned from doing this, because I did this, like, I think my, so I want you to imagine the American College of Veterinary Pathologists. These are people who are MD, PhDs, normally. Most of them are academics, so very, very, very brainy people. And they had so much fun. They laughed. They couldn't stop laughing, because when you work so far out in the future, you have to get a little bit outrageous. And when that outrageousness happens, people start to laugh, and they concoct all these things. Oh, that can't possibly happen, but we'll put it in our story. However, what you realize in hindsight, if you go back and read those stories 5 years later, is almost everything you thought was going to happen in 10 or 15 years has already started. And so you get this, oh, wow, we were really prescient. But you're prescient because of how the technique is set up, not because people are necessarily prone to thinking strategically.
Fascinating. Huh. What other questions does the group have?
Hello? Hi.
Hello.
Hi, this is Julia Palmer. I'm an engineering student, and I'm researching with my advisor a way to bring storytelling into engineering and, like, in preference communication. And I was wondering if you have any suggestions on how to create a vision story for doing this, or, like, any suggestions at all. Because engineers tend to not use storytelling very much, so I was wondering if you had any ideas.
Any ideas on whether or not it would be beneficial for you to do a vision story to kick off your project?
Basically, yeah.
I would if I were you, because I think that if you don't know, I'm going to use a very personal example. So this might seem kind of trite, but I'll tell you about the outcome of it. When I was a kid and I was 10 years old, I was deathly afraid of water. I mean, to the point where my mother could not even wash my hair if I was taking a bath. I would scream at the top of my lungs. Now, what my parents knew that I didn't know is that we were going to move a few months later into a home where my father was planning to build a huge outdoor pool. So I had to learn to swim. And what my parents were most concerned about was the summer where this was all happening. It was going to occur the next year, but my father, we had gone on vacation, and my father had just playfully thrown me into a pool at a resort, and I sat at the bottom of the pool. I did not come up. I was just like not the normal kid. And so they panicked, because all they could think of was, oh, my gosh, our child is going to drown. If she falls into the pool, she's got to learn how to swim. So my parents had this dream, and they came to me and they said, one night, if you remember, I was sitting in bed, and they said, we've signed you up in several months for 6 weeks of swimming lessons, and we just want you to think about that. We never talked about it anymore. And what I recall with great clarity as a child is when I would go to sleep every night, I would visualize myself being able to swim the lap of a pool and being able to do it successfully. Now, I didn't know. I mean, I was 10 years old. I didn't understand visualizations or meditation or anything like that. But what I can tell you is the next summer when my parents put me in the water and I had my first swim instructor, within 6 weeks of literally being fearful of water to the end of my last class, I joined the swim team and swam competitively for years that followed.
Wow.
And so I am a real believer that when we co-create a vision story for what done looks like with a variety of people, we have the ability to embody those words within our DNA. And when that happens, change just starts to occur. Because what we can do with that story is then say, we can back up from it, and I've done this with clients, one in particular in technology, is we wrote a vision story for the future of technology in a government organization, then backed up from it and said, what are the projects we need to do to make that a reality? And 3 years later, I'm here to tell you that they identified 9 projects, And when the head of, when the CIO was asked by an outsider who had come to a meeting with DNI, and I didn't even know this until he told it to him, when he was asked how many of those projects were successful, the CIO laughed and said, they all were. And that's because we had a vision story. Nobody fought them. There wasn't a lot of resistance. We knew that if we wanted the vision and the vision was attractive enough for people and everyone contributed in the organization to it, that the projects were a no-brainer. We had to do them to get that reality to come to fruition. And so I would encourage you to think about, you know, how could you develop, co-create a vision story for what that would look like in your program.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. You have to make us a promise. You have to send it to us, right, so that we all can see what it looks like.
Of course.
What other?
So this is Bill. I'd like to follow up, if I can, on Julia's question just a little bit. What would you think that a vision story would look like for a project which was going to try to introduce undergrad engineers to storytelling? Would it be, this is what our program looks like, you know, sort of at the school, or this is what an engineer does differently once they get out in the workplace because they were exposed to this?
Well, you still use the hallmarks of story, right? So a story has to be created around a singular character. Story has to have, now because it's a vision story, it's going to have some interesting, unique structural pieces to it, as well as content pieces. So it still has to have conflict, a variety of conflicts in it that are solved by the vision. But the way in which you might write the story is not to write it the way we typically do with the traditional story structure, which is here's context, here's the problem, and here's the solution that happened, and everybody goes home, you know, happy. You will write it by talking about, it could be in hindsight, it could be as someone who has gone through your program. But the way this happens is maybe they're sitting, the first part of the story is, and I'm just brainstorming this, you know, they're, oh, my gosh, once again, you know, I've been given you know, the project in the organization that has failed 3 times. And, you know, why is it that I always get this project? And then the person kind of steps back and says, well, I know why I get these projects, and that's because I know how to rally people. I know how to inspire and engage them. You know, so the person's sitting there and thinking, yeah, you know, maybe what I need to do is, to get people to tell me stories on the project team, because, you know, they're not going to want to do this work, about just what each of their sense, what would success look like for them? Like, tell me a story about, or a situation that would depict what success would look like for you. Or maybe you have them tell stories about their worst moments on the previous teams that failed. I don't know, either one. And then maybe at the end of that meeting, people come up to this individual and say, you know, that's like one of the best meetings we ever had. You know, what is this that you're asking us to do? And then you say, well, what I'm going to have us do next time at our next meeting is, I was thinking that you know, we have to go back to the business case, and with the business case, we're going to have to try to sell it to other people, and the only way I know to sell it to other people is to create a story. And the person says, well, tell me more about what you mean. Tell me, you know, about a business case story. And then you go into that. So I would probably use some aspects of an engineer's work and a single engineer and weave in all the different things that they would have learned, but I would do it in such a way so that people could see the application, and that's the sort of engineer you want to bring out of the program and the level of success that they'd like to have. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does to me. Thank you. And Julia, I hope that was helpful for you also.
Yeah, that's good.
I think what I would collect in advance from your alumni, if you have the ability to do so, I would be going out to your alumni engineers and saying, tell me about the sorts of issues that you've been chronically facing in your career as an engineer, and see if somehow the use of story can overcome those.
All right. That's a good idea.
I like that. That's great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Nice approach. What other questions does the group have?
Yeah, Lori.
Hi, it's Jules. I'm sorry. I was wondering, in your writings and your Business for Dummies, is there like maps that you've created, kind of like little road maps that would guide us through some of these queries, like a process? It's not very engineering right now, but knowing, having worked with engineers, it prompted the fact that when I've coached people or worked with them in-house, what made all the difference was having a process for them. They felt much more comfortable and they could loosen up a little bit and relax. They knew they had a process they were going to follow.
So be a little bit more specific with me. You mean a process for crafting stories or a process for deciding on different types of feature stories to use? Or
The latter, basically. The story piece I get, but it's the scenario, like when you make the choice, basically, about which direction you take them in.
You know, we introduce these types of stories in the chapter on organizational change. And then I wrote a follow-up article where the example I've given you, and I can email you. If you send me an email, I can email you the follow-up article that was in a newsletter for the Association for Strategic Planning that just talks about the example that I've spoken to on our call today. But the processes themselves, I haven't published yet. I hold workshops. Like, I've taught, like, organization development consultants the process for how to make these decisions, because they're oftentimes the people inside of organizations who are helping others to do this work, but I haven't yet put it into like a workbook. But that's a really great idea. the next one's going to go back to the topic in May on storifying data. That's what I'm working on right now, along with some other client pieces. But yes, both of these threads that I've done the story labs around are two of my interest areas, but I'd love to talk more about that sometime if you wouldn't mind just pinging me and kind of letting me know what would be the type of resource that would be valuable to you, because I'm more than happy to think about how to put that together, which is why I love these calls, because they give me innovative ideas as well.
Terrific. Wonderful. Thank you.
Anybody else? Any other questions or thoughts?
Yeah, this is Tom, and I was interested, Lori, just to, I don't know if you have this available, but I'd kind of like to hear an actual future story. So do you have, like, an example of how, I know you described some of it, but I'd kind of like to hear just, like, how one might sound.
Here's the dilemma. Those are typically covered by non-compete agreements. because they're multiple pages long and people see them as their strategic advantage. So I only have one that I am able to hand out, which is a project, a vision story. I use it in workshops, but I'm not able to disclose others just because of the confidential nature of my work. But suffice it to say, these are not short stories. They often could go on for 4 to 6 to 8 pages, and I mean single spaced lines. They're very involved. They are, because they're not anecdotes. While they are a story, the descriptive nature within the story and the number of conflicts that people confront are really rich. And in addition, there may be multiple layers of vision stories. So, for example, it takes me back to like 1990-91. And again, I didn't realize I was doing this work at the time, but we created a vision story for an organization that was in 20 different states in the U.S. Then we went to each business unit and said, based on this organizational vision story, what's the vision story for your business unit? Then we went down to the department level and said, based on these two vision stories, the one for the organization and the one for your business unit, what's the vision story for your department? And we layered them. So those stories became richer and richer and much more granular as we got toward the frontline level. And then eventually people were able, all the position descriptions in the organization were aligned to those stories, which is quite phenomenal. They were aligned to those stories and to the workflow map that we were doing at the same time. So unfortunately, other than the one I've just mentioned, I don't And I'm happy to send it to you as an example. Again, if you ping me, I'm not able to share other client examples just because of the nature of the work I do.
Okay, but it's a lot different than creating a vision statement. And it sounds like you've got many, many layers that go into the future stories that you help create.
Yeah, you know, a vision statement, to me, it's taking a vision statement and exploding it. Because vision statement, and the way I write back, I just had this conversation today with some people at a company, because they said to me, what's the question you answer when you write a vision statement? And I said, well, my question's different than yours. I say, in the eyes of future consumers, what do we need to become? Now, what's so powerful about that question is, they said, oh, my gosh, we have multiple consumer segments. I'm like, yeah, you can have vision stories for each one of those segments. And then they kind of, those stories then are like persona stories. Because if you understand the world that your future consumers are going to be operating in, then you can back up from that and say, what is our vision story going to look like?
Yeah, and so it's interesting. It just, if I could check in with this. So are your vision stories, are they things, I mean, these future stories, the way you're describing them, do they ever get told? Are they only read?
They are often acted out. I mean, I love to see them in skits. I like to see huge murals around them, pictorial. So they're much more dealing with the unconscious mind. Sometimes, I mean, they're oftentimes in all different forms of media because we all access things differently. So for even like the skits I mentioned to you, we videotaped those skits and we sent them around the country so people could watch them. I mean, we didn't have that capacity or capability at that time to download them to a website for people to watch at home because not many people had the electronic means to download at that time back in 2007, 2008 time frame. But I want you to think, like, really creatively about, well, how do we embody this? What are all the different sorts of things to do that we can embody? And what are the sorts of triggers, story triggers? I mean, actual artifacts that the organization might need to create that would embody the story itself.
And were the skits that, you know, as you described them, mm-hmm. were they more than half-baked? I mean, were they written, rehearsed, and, like, honed?
Yeah, yep. You got it. And this is with volunteers. This isn't even with employees. You got it. These folks were amazing. I can't even begin to tell you the number of hours they were willing to put into this. And what this taught me, especially with volunteers, is that when people are inspired and they can see that the strategy is going to make a difference, they will do almost anything to bring it to life for their colleagues.
What was the time period like of the development of the skits?
Oh, probably. We were doing a lot of work, I would say, over the period of like 3 months. I mean, I don't know how many phone calls I had because I would come in and out intermittently because I was fine with just having kind of, once we agreed on what the frame of the story, the vision story was going to be for their strategy, then I just kind of let them loose. And then I would insert things like, well, you're doing too much describing. You need to do more dialogue. Or I don't see enough conflict in here. You need to beef up the conflict. So that's the sort of feedback that I gave to them. But I wanted it to be their own words and for it to be touching. And they all were. I mean, they all were. They all had a range of emotions in them.
And where did they go to? Were you aiming for like a central meeting or conference?
Yes, we were doing the 350-person meeting that I mentioned to you so we could orient the entire board plus more people to what we had done in strategic planning so that the board could vote on it and approve it.
So maybe I misheard. So was there kind of an anchor meeting in the beginning where you had all 350 people come together and then you had another meeting that they were heading towards to?
Well, we created the strategy with 75 people, only some of which were I would say, so there are 52 board members. When we brought 75 people to create the strategic plan, we did not include all 52 board members because I like to do what I call max mix groups, meaning I want the maximum mix of diversity so I know that the strategy is sound, that it's been vetted by a lot of different voices and people. And so after those 75 created it, I made the wrong assumption. I still remember going to the executive director and saying, okay, so when do we implement? She's like, whoa, no, Lori. We got all the rest of the board members to orient to all of this. We have committee chairs to orient to this. We have, you know, the unspoken leaders in the organization to orient. And I'm like, oh, yay, yay. So that's when we created this real-time strategic change event that went over a 24-hour period on purpose. So it started like Saturday at noon, went till like 7 o'clock on Saturday night. I wanted people to be able to be together, sleep together, eat together, talk about it, and then come back the next day and do more work up until about noon or 1 o'clock, and then they voted on it later that afternoon.
And so they did the stories. They voted, they talked about it. Did they come back and rewrite the script and show it in theatrical form, the changes?
When the meeting happened with 350 people, that's when the skits happened. It was a much larger design. So a real-time strategic change event is designed down to the minute. So I want you to imagine 8 to 10 hours, every single minute is scripted about what we're going to do, but nobody knows that in the audience. And it's there's a little bit of presentation, then a whole lot of group table action, then a little bit of presentation, a whole bunch of group table action. And every time there's group table work, the results of their table work is typed up immediately by another group of people and turned back to them. That's why it's called real time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like this tremendous amount of energy and surge of things happening, but we only give them pieces of information that we've orchestrated. And then they have to say, what's the meaning in it for me? And so all the activities were thought about in advance and so on. The story pieces that I've given you were just portions of a larger design.
Mm-hmm.
So one question that I have, this is Bill Brown, would be, do you start out by potentially going to a futurist, one of the people who's actually predicting greater trends in the future? Do you start by gathering some of those as a starting point and then build your scenarios around the actual company participating in some way in one of those scenarios, one of the futurist predictions?
Well, what I do, and this I'll tell you, is different than the way vision stories started years ago. So there are multiple ways to do vision stories, but the way that we used to create them a long time ago, and different from the client I've shared with you, is people would just sit in a room and say, what do we want the future to look like a year from now or 2 years from now or 3 years from now? Well, I'm a strategist. That doesn't work so well for me because I know from the research done at MIT and other places that that's myopic. I will never be able to predict what the future is going to do with the resident knowledge that we have in the room. So what I do is I do an environmental scan independent of whatever research is being done in the organization, because there might be some intelligence work that is currently going on. But I have, I take my client group, I have a database of questions around various categories like politics, the social environment, the economic environment, technology, and so on. And I say to my client representatives, write in each category for me 5 to 6 to 7 questions that if you could have the answers to them 5 to 10 years from now through a crystal ball would be unbelievably helpful. We write those questions, and then the members who are going to be in strategic planning go out on the web in search of information. So yes, they may go to a futurist who is maybe has information in the world of technology. They may go to a futurist who has information in healthcare. But quite frankly, there's so much stuff out there that you're going to because there are one-off, what I call one-off thought leaders that no one ever talks about, and they've got blogs or they've got ebooks or they've got other sorts of things, and when you read them, you go, oh, my gosh, that's the next so-and-so. And so we collect all that printed information, and we put them, I mean, this is kind of old school, but we put them into binders. I said I have these huge board books, and we sift through them to make certain that we have articles that in some way answer every question, but the articles don't agree with each other.
Of course not.
We don't want them to, right? And then we have people,
right.
People are assigned to the different categories, and I just say, okay, there's 10 articles in your category. Read them. Do not judge them. And give me a 5 to 7 minute synopsis, and that's going to kick off a 30 to 45 minute discussion on your category. But remember, I'm being hired as a strategist, so people see this as part and parcel of doing strategic work. So they're willing to spend a day going through this information and looking at the implications of what's there. And then that output can be used in scenarios. That output can be used to create a vision statement. The output can be used to talk about what their breakthrough strategies are going to be. It has multiple applications. But what it's done is it's made them recognize that they don't have enough knowledge in there just by virtue of their own readings and what they know themselves to answer strategic questions, that you really do have to have some sort of active scanning process going on, and that it answers the right sorts of questions for them.
That's amazing. It sounds like a very detailed process, but also a lot of fun for everybody and creates a very engaging approach. I want to be sensitive to our time, but I love the fact that there's a lot of active engagement on the call. Any other questions before we close out? Okay. So let me go ahead and close out, and then Lori will kind of conclude with thanking you. And just a moment, please.